Welcome to Lectionary Call-In for Tuesday, June 22nd of 2021, where two laypersons, a pastor, and an academician gather for about 50 minutes each week to discuss the Gospel Lectionary for the coming Sunday. This Sunday is June 27th. Each Tuesday, we call in from wherever we may be at 6:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and for our good friend Charles Willard in Minnesota, that's 5:30 a.m. Our little team is working to be faithful to Lectionary Year B, and we hope this discussion will provide areas of focus and reflection. Here's how it works. We develop perspectives independently with the help of the leadoff person who shares some formative questions. We're doing a little different today, and our friend Bill Hull will explain that to you in a moment. And then in this virtual discussion room, we share, encourage, and we challenge each other. And here are the folks that are joining us in today's discussion.
Bill Hall in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Sarah Mickelson in Tampa, Florida.
Charles Willard in Minnesota.
And I'm Don Upton in Charlotte, North Carolina. And Bill Hall is in the lead today. We can't wait to see what he has in store for us. Hello, Bill.
Good morning, team members, and good afternoon, good evening to those viewing and listening later. We welcome you. Today's passage from the lectionary in the gospel is Mark 5, verses 21 to 43. And I've asked my colleagues to read this in parts. You will quickly recognize a familiar narrative, or I should say narratives. There are two different stories here. So we will begin by listening to the word of the Lord, and Charles, you're up first.
When Jesus had crossed, this is Mark chapter 5, verses 21 to 43. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue named Jairus came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live."
So he went with him, and a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, for she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed from her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you, and how can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it, but the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in, fear and trembling, fell down before him and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease."
While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, and brother James, and they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue. He saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, and he all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat.
Thank you, colleagues. I was introduced to a new word this week, reading a commentary by Matthew Skinner, whom many of us are familiar with from Working Preacher. He introduced me to a word and concept that is new to me, intercalate. The dictionary's definition is to insert or position something between or among existing elements or layers, for example, in and among geological formations or other structures. In terms of this week's scripture passage, Matt Skinner says, intercalation invites readers to consider two stories in light of each other to discover more through comparison and contrast than if the stories were told entirely separately. In this particular passage, the pairing of two stories offers a rich characterization of Jesus' healing ministry and the multifaceted salvation he brings. End of Matt's quote. And I found that helpful and suggested to my colleagues that they not only look at these two stories, but the stories are told also in Matthew 9 and Luke 8, and I offered them the parallels of in the three different accounts, asking us to look at the intercalation of the two stories in each of these synoptics, and then what details are offered or left out of the three gospel accounts. So we're overlaying various things here. And before we begin to deal with the questions, our friend Charles Willard, one of the many gifts he brings is his wealth of knowledge based on his professional experience, and he found an article on this issue of intercalation. And by the way, on a personal note, today is Charles and Nancy's 58th wedding anniversary. Happy wedding anniversary, Charles and Nancy. And Charles, if you would, could you review that article for us, and then we'll proceed.
One of the nice things about the studies and the kinds of resources that librarians have over the years by collecting and analyzing and then publishing analyses of these articles that appear in scholarly journals. The theological librarians have been doing this for over half a century. And so that we can look back and find things that have been written a long time ago. And sometimes, as in this instance, it's a very happy discovery that I made in this case, because I found an article dealing exactly with the questions that the question in particular that Bill has raised and asked us to look at today, or asked us to take an approach using today. And the thing that made it fascinating was that it was written by a scholar, James R. Edwards, and that name sounded familiar to me. And I remembered, and I went back and checked, and sure enough, my professional work as a theological librarian began at Princeton Seminary, and I overlapped with James R. Edwards for the first 2 years that I was there. That was the last 2 years at Princeton Seminary. He graduated and went on to graduate school elsewhere, and then continued a number of other places and continues to work. But he wrote his name, and it's officially James R. Edwards. My recollection was that he was known as Jimmy Edwards at the time. And so what Jimmy Edwards has done, but 10 years later, by the time he's now James R. Edwards, he wrote this article called Mark and Sandwiches. And what Bill is describing is the results of an analysis of the text that we have, which is, it's got these two stories that are sort of mushed together. And James Edwards' term for this is a Markan sandwich. And this is not the only sandwich that Mark serves up in his menu of choices of text described that way. There's a general agreement among scholars that there are five such sandwiches in Mark, and Professor Edwards discovers four others. But the point of talking about a sandwich is, as Bill has said, is ask ourselves what sense that makes. How does that contribute to what we learn? And so I want to back up for just a minute though and say that one of the problems that we have, we need to remember when we're talking about these texts that we're looking at, we have to ask ourselves what level and what kinds of lenses we are viewing these stories. One is what really happened. That is, did it ever happen in the life of Jesus that he had this encounter? I mean, there's no question that he had this encounter with Jairus, the leader of the synagogue. There's no doubt that he had this encounter with the woman with a hemorrhage. But the question is, did they happen as they were described by Mark? So that's one thing we have. Did they, they happen? What, and then what Mark reports? And then further, because we have these two other parallel gospels to Mark, which seem to have used Mark substantially, but then used it in different ways, so that what we get in Matthew and in Luke is another picture of the same scene. And it doesn't help our conversation, because we can never know the answer. You know, what really happened? We don't know that. And we don't really know whether Matthew and Luke were fixing Mark because they knew better than Mark, or they were fixing Mark because their fix better focused what Mark was having to say on their particular group, their particular audience that they had in mind when they were creating these gospels. But let's go back to the story of Jairus and the woman with the flow, and I'll simply reveal the ending at the very beginning, and then I'll stop talking. The ending, as discerned by Professor Edwards. I'll just read this so that you get his words instead of my taking on it. What happens when you have all these papers? They're all there. Okay. The conclusion he reaches is the woman's faith forms the center of the sandwich, which is the key to its interpretation. The woman's faith, the woman who is unnamed, she is the one whose faith forms the center of the sandwich and the key to its interpretation. Through her, Mark shows how salvation and faith in Jesus can transform fear and despair into hope and salvation. It's a powerful lesson for Jairus as well as for Mark's readers. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Charles. Now, what's different this week is ordinarily the lead sends two or three focused questions, and that's what we deal with. I've asked my colleagues to forego that this week and to study this passage in all three of the synoptics, and then I'm going to offer them some questions that they don't have in advance. So I hope this is more just an open back and forth conversation. Now, the basic approach is I'm going to begin by looking at the parts of these narratives, and then, time permitting, we'll come to, okay, how do we put these parts together and form a conclusion? And Charles just offered us an example from his professor friend. First of all, and Sarah, I'll start with you. What does the narrative tell us, and what might we infer about the women? What do we learn about the women? What might we infer?
Both of the women are daughters. Both of the women are passive to some extent in their practice. The daughter in Jairus' situation is 12. And the woman that's talked about in the second, or I should say the sandwiched story, has been dealing with hemorrhages for 12 years. So there's some common ground there. The 12-year-old woman is about to start the story of reproductive processes, and the woman who's been hemorrhaging for 12 years is moving toward ending her reproductive processes. So there's something to be said for that. Interestingly enough, both of these people are given the opportunity to continue. So Jesus walks them through for them what has been an end-of-life experience. I think for the woman, she has been, she's been outcast. She's been living on the margins of her culture. She's been invisible and ignored. And the 12-year-old child is going through a physical death rather than a community death. So I think both of these women are restored to their families. Both of these women are lifted up as examples of the healing that Christ is bringing, the restoration that Christ is bringing. I think that it's interesting to me that one started on the outside of society and moved back into what I would call the family nucleus, and one is moved from the family nucleus out and brought back. So there's some wonderful things that happen there. That's just my first blush.
Good. Thank you, Sarah. Don?
Well, first, just a piece. They're both dependent on the Christ and their stories. Neither, I could say, are the absolute priorities of the society in their own. And both require advocacy, but in different ways. The child, the advocacy of a father who is venturing out at a distance. And the other, her own advocacy. And then the final one would be there is this, they both have the need of the presence of the Christ, but boy, is it different. In the words of several commentators, you know, the agency of the Christ, the woman touches his garment is unconscious, it just happens. And with the other, there is an intent, even an intent in time, that there is, it's not that there's no hurry at all, but the work of the Christ will be done in its own time. And it is intentional and it is expressed. So the two extremes in terms of the agency of the Christ. That's what I've got.
Thank you. Charles, the women.
Yes. I wanted to make one comment, and that is that Mark Davis brings this up for us, and it's something that you get in the Greek text, but has been smoothed out by the translation so that it seems like it runs along in a neat little set of full clauses. It doesn't. It's phrases which are not completed. And so this is looking now at verses 25 and 26. In 25 and 26, there are these particles, so that it should read like this. The woman being in a flow of blood for 12 years and having suffered much by many physicians and having spent all that she had and not having benefited, but had gone from bad to worse. Having heard about Jesus, having gone to the crowd, she grabbed his garments from behind, and she was saying, if only I grab his garment, I will be made whole. Finally, it gets all of that, but it's one that's just going to boom, to boom, to boom, to boom, to boom, to boom, to boom. And in the Greek text, it's sort of you run along and you're carried along by these repeated participles that don't get completed until she grabbed his clothing and... We know the rest of the story.
Thank you. That was helpful. I will just add a couple of things because much of what came to me has been noted. Charles mentioned earlier, yet again, both women are nameless. But the woman with the hemorrhage does have a voice, though not named. She speaks for herself, and I think Don noted this. The girl is not able to speak, and her father speaks for her. So, again, the intercalation, it's noting for us something of the pattern of Jesus's ministry. In some cases, the person asks for help. Like there's a story of the man who was demon-possessed and he cries out to Jesus. And other stories, someone or ones act on behalf of someone. We know the story of the men who went up on the roof and opened it up and lowered the man to Jesus. So I think that's part of the overall pattern, and we'll get to the bigger picture later. And both women are in crisis. One is immediate. And it, I think it's, I'm not certain, at least in Matthew or Luke or both, she's already dead in the account. In Mark, she's dying. So one is immediate and one is of many years. Again, a juxtaposing that Jesus responds to something of the moment and something that's been happening for a long time. And it strikes me, and this is shaped some by the commentaries I read and what we know or think we know of the culture, this woman violated social customs. If I read it correctly, she comes up behind him. She's hoping not to be seen. And what I take from that is that she understood the culture. You know, I'm not supposed to do this, but in spite of it, I'm going to try surreptitiously to get what I need. And it's noted, I think, Sarah, you did, that both are daughters. In one case, that's the identifier. And in the other, Jesus calls the woman with the hemorrhage a daughter, a term of endearment. Now, we're going to move to Jesus. And let me note something, and we don't need to dwell long here. If you listen to the followers of the way, they deal with this. Where is Jesus? The passage begins when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side. And in, where is it? Oh, in Luke, it says, now when Jesus returned, the likelihood is he has gone from the western Gentile side of the sea back to the eastern predominantly Jewish side. But I don't know that we can know for sure, but I think it's likely that he's back now in his home territory. What do we learn about Jesus? Don?
I think we learn about the timelessness of Jesus, even the Son of Man walking on the earth, flesh and blood, that there's a breakthrough here. And I think if you believe in the sandwich, which I'll challenge at some point today, that it, the intent of that is to show this inbreaking on time and place. His presence seems to matter, which goes to his ascension later on, but this incredible breakthrough. So this is a Christ in this story, sandwiched in this way, with no preconditions. In other words, Christ doesn't have to be on time. The on-timeness of Christ is eternal. And because he's quoting scriptures, he is blending those together with his ministry. So the on-time is, I think, very important. This is a Christ that requires no triage, even though the people around him are living in a world where there are preconditions. You must come to me first. I think triage is an interesting word. Triage is important. saves lives. It gives us priorities. We know who can and cannot be saved. Doctors can make decisions. Who goes first? That doesn't matter here. And I think one of the reasons these stories are put together is it's just meant to be a wash through of those things. It doesn't matter. And some of these comparable passages you've given us, the sense is that the Father is pleading for the presence of Jesus, not just to be on time, hurry. There's no need for hurry here. But that his pleas probably are after she's passed. And it still goes forward. And I also would say this is a Jesus that is still being confronted with obstacles on our terms. So this little combination of stories I go to last week where what is the obstacle is they are crossing. They're crossing a sea and a storm comes up. And what does Jesus do? It's not an obstacle at all. He says, peace. He wipes the weather clean. And in this one, I think there's an obstacle, and after an obstacle, we think there's an obstacle. Someone touches his garment. The Matthew passage, the version of this, actually begins with something like, meanwhile, he's talking, so we already, this whole piece is interrupting him and something that's already going face. It's obstacle after obstacle after obstacle, so says the human being. But this is, in the first, last week, Jesus wipes the weather clean. There will be no obstacle to get across the sea for the ministry. There will be none at all. And I think his disciples were as astonished by that as they were fearful in the middle of a storm. In this case, I think there's another wiping clean that's taking place, which is the timelessness, even of the ministry of the Son of Man, but before sacrifice. That all that's wiped clean. And what I would hold out to you is it may be viewed as stratify, you know, why do we put a story within a story on top of a story? But for me, I will reject that just for fun and go, I don't think it's stratification. I don't think it's a sandwich. I think it's a blender. That's what I got.
Okay. Charles, what do we learn about Jesus?
I pass.
Okay. Thank you. Sarah?
I think that where Jesus is the if the chiastic ideas that are put forth as a literary structure that the book of Mark uses, and I think it's a literary structure, represents or is fed by the Greek letter X. And so in the Greek letter X, if you imagine, there's 4 points and a central meeting joint or a meeting place where those lines cross. I think that throughout the book of Mark, Jesus is that spot where time, dialogue, epilogue, prologue all meet. And that so wherever Jesus moves through the story of Mark, that's the central point of the X. And I think Jesus uses this to draw our eye to what's valuable versus what's temporal. What's man-made versus what's deemed by God or created by God. So I'm thinking about the language of Kairos versus Chronos. And in this story, Jairus is experiencing a Chronos moment, that the time that is passing is precious and it's not going to be returned. And Jesus is presenting that story with a Kairos sense of time, in that wherever we are right now is the most important place to be. And that's because we're in the kingdom of God. We're not moving through with a clock or a chronometer measuring the passage of the day. So Jesus is going to get there in the perfect amount of time. I'm struck by this sense that Jesus is sensitized to being touched and the flow of power moving from him to the woman. There's something lovely about being a reciprocal receiver or reciprocal transfer. Almost as if electrons have to move from the positive to the negative to balance the equation. We're seeing something similar happen here when she touches the hem of his garment. She is approaching him, unclean, a woman, in public, and she's trying to do it in the most discreet way she can because she does not want to be seen. She's supposed to disclose unclean, like a leper would, and yet she touches the hem of his garment in an effort to meet that sense of healing. Almost as if lightning moves up from the ground and down from the sky at the same time to meet in the middle. And I think that's what we're witnessing here, is when a person in need who is hungry for the body of Christ meets the body of Christ, it's something magical happens, something miraculous happens. And Christ is on his way to meet Jairus' daughter and encounters the woman. And it's still the same level of importance, the same level of healing. It's the same, even though in human terms, the woman who's touching the hem of the garment is less than. And the daughter of Jairus is more than. So I think it's interesting that Jesus doesn't put value on the miraculous. It's all miraculous, and it's all human need, and it is human restoration, and that's what he's come to do.
Thank you. In terms of my reflection on this, I would say for myself, this passage illustrates something that I think consistently is at least suggested throughout the gospel accounts of Jesus' life and ministry. He consistently confounds the disciples, those around him, and us today. How is this possible? How is any of this possible? For example, a couple of examples. I read the text to say that she did not, the woman with the hemorrhage did not touch Jesus. She just touched his garment. Okay, if you only touch my sleeve and I don't see you do it, then how am I able to perceive that power has gone out of me? That's a whole other subject. Here's the Son of God able to perform these miracles, and yet something goes from him. I think that's very rich, that ministry to others does take something from us. And so there's that sense that Jesus is always in some ways more than we can understand. And certainly we can't contain Jesus, because logic would argue with what happened here. But we are told that this is what Jesus did. I'm also struck that we're told that great crowds were following him, and it's almost as if that didn't matter to Jesus. The immediate need of the moment is what mattered to Jesus, not popularity, but a need. And again, a consistent thing I think we learn about Jesus is, this would be my way of putting it, he honored boldness and assertiveness. And for me, that relates to his statement to the woman, your faith has made you well. He doesn't say, I healed you. He says, your faith has made you well. And that's a mystery. There's grace, but there's also our choice. And I think we have to leave it there, that it's a mystery. How much is God and how much is us? And one way I can, and I'll briefly refer to this, relate to it, is that if we are offered assistance, we have a choice whether or not to accept it. This is a human example. And if we reject it, that we have the power to do that. So this woman had enough faith that she was willing to reach out And Jairus had faith that Jesus could make a difference. So somehow, in that mysterious mix, there's a lesson for us. And again, there's a book, I think it's by Yancey, I'm not sure, The Jesus I Never Knew, and another one by another author, Meeting Jesus for the First Time, that Jesus is consistently confounding, even confusing, and challenging us. The other person in this story is Jairus. What do we know about Jairus? Charles, you want to begin?
No, thank you. I'm coming later.
Okay. Sarah, Jairus.
You know, I think about fathers in relationship to this. We've just come to Father's Day, and it's the value or the importance of fathers being an agent of protection, an agent of advocacy, someone that seeks the best for his child. I think those are all wonderful explanations. We already know that he's also a leader in the synagogue, which tells us that he's living a life with intention, that he's living a life of practice, of discipline, and that he probably has a household that works in that same way. So if we see him as a representation of family structures, his faith is valuable in that the rest of his life is built with that as a foundation. And I think that's important here. I think it's also, you know, we have no definition for the woman except to say we know that she's part of the family of Abraham, that she is called daughter. And I think that's an interesting perspective of what it means to be a part of a family. And Jairus represents what it looks like when you're a part of a family, and the woman who touches the hem of the garment is what it feels like when you're outside the family. So I see that as an interesting perspective. The fact that Jairus advocates as a leader already, it tells me he's comfortable in that position. And he recognizes Jesus' authority, and he asks for that authority to be applied to his daughter. And that's a bold act.
Okay, thank you. Don, Jairus.
Privilege. You can apply that to any privilege discussion that we may be having in the 21st century. What does privilege mean? First in line. Entitlement. Me first. My daughter first. Now. Right? And of course, in any urgency, we try to leverage what we have, any position to help somebody that we love or help ourselves on a selfish level. Now. So I think the privilege matters. You should be first in line. What an interesting turn on the first shall be last. If he's naturally the first, then she comes in the triage last. Beyond all understanding, she has passed away. It doesn't matter. So he's an important part of the story, and that there's a reversal here. But I think the gospel is all over this, because the first shall be last does not mean you are lost. It means that time is not there for you. The child is being advocated for out of time. Two advocates in a way, Christ, and we've got the Father. So that's the first idea. The second is, I think you can apply something Christ-like to him in terms of understanding. I'm not saying he is exactly like the Christ, but I think he is an advocate. And I think Christ, the connection would be Christ is the advocate out of time. It's part of that on an eternal level. And so what he does in this literature is allow us to look at the urgency, at the temporal, the time. He's locked in time. Something has to be done in time. It allows Christ to be revealed as a part of his story. The passage of time actually doesn't matter. And then finally, just that he sees, and he does this, I think, in public, that just like the woman tries to go undercover, it is revealed, who is that? you know, and she's like, oh gosh, you know, and here, and I could see the faces turn. What is this? What has happened? What has she done? Who is this person? He is very public in what he's doing. And it becomes a private engagement when he brings just a few people in to the daughter. But I think his very bold, public, I see Jesus, I'm going to say this, you must come, a recognition, just like she recognizes by reaching out, he recognizes in a much more bold way. Those are my thoughts.
Thank you. What I would add is this. We know that controversy had arisen among the religious leadership. It's possible, we don't know this, that Jairus was already, being an official in the synagogue, aware of the controversy about Jesus. That's possible. If he did, in spite of it, and I'm echoing what has already been said, what's most important to him at this moment is his daughter. And it adds it to me for Mark to note that Jairus saw Jesus, fell at his feet, and begged him repeatedly, almost humiliating himself, or if not humiliating, here's this distinguished biblical scholar, religious leader, who's just literally throwing himself on the ground and begging Jesus. And as you noted, Sarah, I thought of it too, reading this in our culture, Father's Day, that when we are at our healthiest as a parent, we will act to protect and nurture no matter what it takes. So I see Jairus as this very human person. You know, I'm an ordained minister, but when the day is done, I'm human. And I care about and worry about my kids and grandkids and would do anything within my power to help them. Now, let me move to this framework that I offered us to operate out of. What difference does it make that the two stories are intercalated, interwoven, or, Don, to use your term, blended? And since I've made an issue of this, I will go first, and I look forward to what you have to say. What difference might it make that the two stories are together? First of all, I don't see any indication in the three accounts of what Jesus wanted to do when he got back to the other side. What he does is deal with what comes to him. It, to me, the intercalating, the blending, tells us that Jesus is approachable. And to be a little funny with words, Jesus is interruptible, yet remains imperturbable, if I said that right. And I thought of myself as a minister. I used to joke, I was one of these who early on bought into the idea of having a prioritized to-do list for each day. And the night before, I would reflect on my schedule and set my priorities. Almost without fail, that to-do list and my rank ordering got transformed. One phone call from an emergency room or whatever would come. And I think that that's a part of Jesus's pattern here. He set his face to go to Jerusalem eventually. There was a purpose, there was a mission, and yet consistently Jesus could be interrupted. And also, I think this blending reminds us of something that's just as important today as it was then, that in Jesus' eyes, gender, status, rank did not matter. Women are equally worthy of his attention and ministry. I think that's a very powerful part of this juxtaposing of the two stories. I think it's clearly illustrated elsewhere, but also here. Okay, Sarah, any thoughts on how it matters that the two stories come together for us?
Well, it seems to me the crux of the stories hinge on verse 36. In the words, do not fear, only believe. So I had occasion to watch a documentary on bubble physics, and I didn't know that this was even a path of study, and I was so excited to discover it. In the moment of bubble physics, when the bubble changes form, it's called a singularity, when the solution of the bubble moves from being a bubble to not being a bubble. And that moment of change, that instant where the form moves from one representation into another, is the important piece there. And they're trying, from a bubble physics standpoint, they're trying to understand how that moment of singularity or that moment of transition occurs. And they see this echoing across the universe. So that's how the sun works. That's how a number of other elements work, that bubble structures work to help us understand how the whole world works. And I saw an echo of that in this particular passage. I think that the moment of singularity in this passage, or the moment of takeaway, is do not fear, only believe. And that is the apex through which the hemorrhaging woman is transformed, and that's the apex through which Jairus' daughter is healed. And Jesus moves the apex of the story wherever he goes. So he becomes that moment of that lens of clarity, and moves throughout the universe or the world that he's operating within, back and forth across the Sea of Galilee, from Gentile to a more traditional Jewish community, to bring the focus in and say, now is the most important time, and you are the most important person. And he restores people to that wholeness. So that's my takeaway.
Thank you. Charles?
I'm wondering, and this is dangerous because it's venturing into unspeculated and unknowable territory. I again appreciate Professor Edwards' comment that it's the woman who is the centerpiece. It's her faith. And she's the one who, without support from Jesus said to Jairus, only believe. She already did. And the proof of the pudding, in this instance, the proof of the pudding was that she was healed. She was healed with no visible outward statement by Jesus, you know, be healed. She just, it happened. Her belief that when she reached out and touched his garment, not to have the command, you know, spirit, get out or whatever, just all she had to do was to touch his garment and she would be healed. And lo and behold, she was. Period. I think that display of kind of unlimited faith was the connection that got made. I don't want to speculate about what would happen if she hadn't really believed in the way that she did, but she did believe, and what we got was the demonstration of the consequences of that power of the belief that had happened. And I'm going to stop with that. I'm impressed with that.
Thank you, Don.
Thanks. Just a few notes, Sarah. I'm really excited about your comments about Jesus and even bringing like physics into it. What I just came to mind was, what is a moving tabernacle actually doing when it's present? And things are just distorted in a way that we beyond all understanding. So I'm thinking about a moving tabernacle all the way through this. The question about the layers or the stratification or the cookies or whatever the analogy is being made, I think that's just a very human thing. And it's a chance to think about, Sarah, you're talking about literature, that this literary device is something that's very human. I think there's a struggle going on here, too, Mark, as a reporter, to figure out how to talk about the timeless Christ, how to talk about the moving tabernacle, when all we have is the strata restricted by time and place. How do we do that? And I think there's a struggle here. I want to say that the day that we're dealing with here is a day filled with miracles, and that these two stories are chosen to demonstrate what's going on. And now I'm wondering, thanks to women, maybe, you know, how of all the stories that lead up to the Gospels, especially the synoptic Gospels, how do they get there? How is those decisions made? And I think there are followers of the way that are women who are going. So there may be advocates here that are insisting that these stories are the right stories to be told about this particular day, this timeless Jesus who doesn't actually have to be on time, that the working out of the healing can take place no matter what. So I'm wondering if there's an advocacy here also of women who are followers of the way, women who are disciples of Christ. But back to, you know, the us and these, the stratification of time, you think about how we enjoy serialization of stories and the pieces. We play God. We love the authors that are playing God because it gives us a glimpse of things that are really impossible. You could pick Charles Dickens or any great writer who cuts things up in pieces and says, meanwhile, back at the castle, well, that's all fantastic. No vision like that, but for the author. I have no ability, even at this moment, I do not know what members of my family are doing. I don't. I'm sitting here with you. That's all I've got. And so I think there's this desire, the human desire to pull these things together, and we delight in it. The difference between what Dickens would do and what we actually see here happening in the reality of Jesus Christ is we prey on each other with time. We have the unfound child who will live a life and never be seen. Meanwhile, back in the other place, meanwhile, back in France, we go, gosh, why did you do that to me? Why will they never meet? Why are the lovers out of time and we'll never actually find out that they were in love with you? Why? And this takes it, even Sarah, you started with talking about literature. This is another form of literature. This is a timeless form that says, right, your desire is to play God with this. Your desire is to see, but you can't get beyond triage. This is something entirely different where we can see all the layers. That's why I'm choosing to say it's more of a blender. The chemistry of these things may matter more than the fact that there are these events that we normally couldn't see. Those are my thoughts, Bill.
Thank you. And I believe
we've got about 3 minutes.
Okay. I will end this way. My final question was going to be, how does this story inform and shape our ministry today? I will share with you quickly my thought and then leave it there, because I think it's best that we all try to build a bridge. And here's what I took away, that ritual and customs are a given in our lives and ministry. None of us are free of our culture, but ultimately, as followers of Jesus Christ, they are not the priority. People in need are to be our focus. Don, I'll hand it back to you, and thank you, team members.
Thank you. Thanks for managing this discussion in a new and different way for us today. I enjoyed it very much. And probably a signal for other facilitators and moderators that listen in. Here's another way to go about this important piece of scripture. And for folks that are watching or listening in, Palmacia Presbyterian Church is at 3501 West San Jose Street. That's in Tampa, Florida. And for more information, you can go to palmacia.org. That's PalmaCia.org. At that site, you are going to find other discussions of the Gospel Lectionary, differences of opinions. It's a great journey, so check that out. Great sermons, prayers, reflections, and outstanding music. And you're always welcome, and we'll see you next time.